When all around seems bleak and grey, it's strange the things that cheer you up. The things that make us smile.
Tony Doyle puts Celtic ahead with the most simple of goals.
See, sometimes it takes a single ray of light to lift the gloom. Deeds that shine on in memories.
The ball at the edge of the box. Smith there for Rangers. Aitken claims it. Celtic possession. Aitken going through. A chance for McCluskey. McCluskey going round the outside of two defenders. McCloy makes the save, but Jackson diverts it into his own net. Disaster for Rangers.
Not just the passing clouds of the day. Things that let us dream just for an instant.
Shoots and scores a sensational goal.
And give us the feeling that we too...
Celtic have won it.
Our winners.
Deep in the castle and back from the wall, back with the Bohemian. Unbelievable scenes amongst the Celtic players. The 10 men have won the championship after being down, seemingly out.
Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady and this is podcast number 227. This week I am joined by St Anthony, and in addition to talking about the current Celtic setup, discussing Ronnie Dyla, pros and cons, as usual, you'll put some context to this intro. So without further ado, this is me, Harry Brady, with him, St Anthony.
So how are you doing, St Anthony?
I'm not bad, Harry. How's yourself?
I'm fine, thanks. I thought it'd be interesting to do a podcast because, as I was joking with someone last night, over the last month, I don't think there's anything that you and I have agreed with on Twitter about the current Celtic team. So I thought it'd be interesting to do that on a podcast. But before we do that, there's an event coming up in your life in the next month. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, well, I've been in the process for the last couple of years of writing a book about the 1978-79 season where Celtic won the league. And I think those of us of a certain age will recall that was the season we played Rangers in the last league game, and we had to win, and we beat them 4-2 with 10 men. And for a couple of years, I've been doing a wee bit of research, I've been doing a wee bit of interviewing some of the team that played that night, and some of the fans who were there to get a wee sort of canvas opinions and get a few memories. So I'm happy to say that everything's came together. And in the next couple of weeks, the book's going to get launched. It will only be available to buy on Amazon online, certainly to begin with anyway. But it will be out in a couple of weeks. And if anybody, as I said, of a certain age or any younger guys who hear their dad or their brother or their grandfather talking about the great 4-2 game in 1979, then this is your chance to find out a wee bit more, because if I say so myself, there's a lot of detail in it. And it's not just about the game. I thought about writing a book about the game on its own merits, but you really have to take the season as a whole into context to appreciate just what an achievement it was. Not only in winning the league that night, but Celtic played something like, from the top of my head, they played something like 16 games in 54 days. The team were playing 3 games a week. And it was an incredible schedule to go through, and they went on a run and kept on winning games and winning games, and it came to a head that night against Rangers where they won the league in very dramatic fashion.
And there's obviously something else more mystical in the typical Celtic folklore of such an event. It's very difficult to see the goals, isn't it?
Yeah, this is added to the... It's almost became a mythical thing because I tell the story in the book of how it wasn't actually the cameraman who went straight that night. It was the program editors, and apparently you can't have according to the research that I did, they weren't allowed to film without the editors actually being there. And it was a tremendous disappointment on the night for everyone, not only for everybody who watched the match, because if you were privileged enough to be there, then that was a highlight enough. But there was a lot of guys out there who heard the result and were watching the STV. It was supposed to be on ScotSport, and it never materialised because it was never filmed. But I also tell the story of how there was a couple of heroes, unlikely heroes, from the Celtic Film Club, who managed to get hold of a very small cine camera and took sort of grainy white, black and white film of the game, which isn't ideal, certainly, but at least it gives you some indication of what went on that night, and it's better than nothing.
And it's also remarkable for, it was the last game of the season, and we won the league, and you couldn't have a league-deciding Celtic Rangers game anymore.
Well, you say that, but that was one of the most dramatic Glasgow derbies ever. And there was remarkably little trouble after the match, less so than you would think. But the other thing about that season to bear in mind is that Celtic never played a league game for 10 weeks. And it meant that they had a big backlog of fixtures. And at one point, we were as low as seventh in a 10-team league. And it was a most unlikely league title victory, because I think it was at the lowest points total that a team had won the league in something like 20, 25 years. And Celtic top scorer that season in the league was Tom McAdam with 7 goals. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing to think that any team could win a league title in any country when your top scorer scored as few as 7 goals. But what we were fortunate is that we got goals from all through the team, and although we didn't rely on one striker to get the goals, everybody pitched in the end.
And what that does, and we will have a podcast closer to in the next couple of weeks as your book comes out, we will have another podcast. We'll talk about it in more detail. But it's interesting you talk about that, because one of the things in the current Celtic setup that I like to think is that sometimes modern football fans lack a bit of context. I do find it funny when, in the last season or so, I've heard people walk out of Celtic Park, not even this season, last season, the season before, and shout over their shoulder, "This is the worst Celtic team I've ever seen." And when I hear fans talk like that, I always think to myself, you've either only just started coming, or you're a liar. Because we've all seen worse performances than that. And your point of top goal scorer being 7 goals is...
7 goals.
It's quite amazing. I mean, particularly when you think of... I remember a couple of years back when the media pundit experts were slating Jan Veregur of Hesselink, because if you can't score more than 20 goals as a Celtic striker, you're a disaster.
That's true. I mean, Veregur did hit the 20 mark in the end, and that certainly should never be classed as failure. But to talk about the supporters, part of the other reason for writing the book was that there was a great bond between the Celtic fans and that Celtic team. And there was times that there was a point during the mid-season that of the 11 league games that Celtic played in November, December, they only won one of them. And yet there's tremendous patience from the supporters at that time. There wasn't any immediate reactions. There wasn't any call for sackings or calls for slashing the team and getting rid of players. It was a different period, a different time. People were much more, I think, patient and much more understanding to what the team was going through at the time than they would be in the modern age. But The other thing to put into context as well, one of the images that I've managed to obtain is the front page of the Daily Record for the day after they won it, because it was the first time in my life that I ever remembered football being in the front page. It's a colour photo of the Celtic team. Danny McGrain's getting held aloft, and there's a wee bit of text underneath that says, "Celtic won the league in dramatic fashion, 10 men," and it goes on to explain it. And that was quite groundbreaking, because the newspapers at that time basically gave you a one-page summary, and that was it. And the football coverage in the Daily Record or any other newspaper at that time would have been no more than 3 pages. Now, these days, if you get a league title decider, you'll get a 16-page pull-out, and for a whole week, you'll get different angles. You'll get the manager's reaction. You'll get exclusives with the guys that got the goals. I think doing that wee bit of research showed me now that perhaps these days there's too much coverage. And the respect that there's a lot of rubbish getting written in the newspapers. And I think that influences people's thinking at times.
I suppose you could argue it's not too much coverage. It's too much bad coverage.
Too much bad coverage, that's exactly.
You know, your point there is it's a lot of stuff saying nothing in particular. That it's not it's not adding value to your experience of going to watch the football. And what was the managerial? I mean, I know we're going to cover this, but I just think it's interesting, and I'm not comparing directly, but just to contrast your point there about the patience of supporters compared to now. What was the managerial position back then?
Well, the my book begins with Jockstein leaving, because that was quite a tremendous event in Celtic's history, because after all that success in the summer of 1978, he moves on. Now, the point I make as well is that was only Celtic's fifth managerial appointment when Billy McNeil took over, and Celtic's 90-year history. And that's astounding to think that you only had 5 men in 90 years. And you know, I think since then, you know, in the last maybe 35 years, off the top of my head, we must have had something like 15 managers in that period. So again, it puts into context of the time. A manager's job is a fairly stable and secure job.
Yeah.
And because Billy McNeil was in his first season, people were cutting him a wee bit of slack and saying, well, you know what, he's took over a team that were struggling in Steve's last season, and he's brought in a few new guys. And really what became apparent was he put his tremendous faith in some of the young players. I mean, guys like Tommy Burns and Roy Aitken and George McCluskey, they were really just young boys. I mean, they were 20, 21 years old. Teddy Provan was 22. Murdo McLeod was 20. Mike Conroy was 19. And these guys were the backbone of the team at that point. And McNeil had moved on some of the more experienced players, with the guys like Joe Craig and Donny Glavin, Alfie Conn, Paul Wilson, who'd been great Celtic stalwarts. But I think Billy maybe felt that their time had passed, and that he wanted to put his faith in the young boys that he could mould a wee bit, and people that would buy into what he was trying to achieve. And the funny thing was, they went from being a very mediocre team in the winter to being a really talented team by the end of the season.
So patience is a virtue with a new manager, is that what you're saying, Sean?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Which gets us on to
our current incumbent.
And as you'll know, my big thing has been that patience is a virtue with a new manager when he's trying to do something different. And I've just been frustrated at how quick, particularly as I grew up in that time that you've just described, where 2 defeats didn't result in everybody asking for the manager to be sacked. I was using the example the other day too, and I can't remember what season it was, but I do remember us getting beaten 3-1, I think it was, at home in the League Cup to Dundee United.
Oh yeah, that was 1980.
Was that
it was actually 3-0.
Was it 3-0?
And I'll tell you, we played Rangers at Ibrox and we get beat 3-0. Next week we played Aberdeen at Parkhead, we get beat 2-0, And in the following midweek, they played Dundee United in the second leg of the semi-final of the League Cup, and they get beat 3-0. And there's a moral to that story as well, because, again, like 1979, it was quite a bad winter in terms of the team's form. But after the new year, Celtic went on a run that year as well and won the league as well. So, again, it's maybe I have to say that Ronnie Dial is not, his results maybe a wee bit disappointing, but they're not as bad as, we're not getting beat 2-3-0, certainly in the Scottish game.
Terms of the difference in support, and this is one of the things, I remember after that game, Jim McLean, not a Celtic man, saying that he wished the Dundee United fans were more like the Celtic fans, because after getting beat 3-0, the Celtic fans were still behind the team until the 90th minute.
And that was the night that the jungle sang all the way through, right until the final whistle. You could argue it was a show of defiance, but certainly they showed a great, if I can use the word loyalty, a great sense of loyalty that night towards the team. And again, there was, the point I make is, times have changed a wee bit, because there was a bond between the players and fans then. Because I think the players were what I would describe as more touchable. And they were mostly Scottish players. They were all guys who, the vast majority of them grew up as Celtic fans, so they had a feel for the club. But it's different these days. But when you look at our market now, it has went beyond the Scotland, and maybe even beyond the UK. So you've got guys from Honduras, you've got guys from Israel, you've got guys from Sweden, you've got guys from a whole host of places, Africa and parts of Asia and things like that. So you can't expect them to have the same desire for Celtic as Johnny Doyle or Tony Burns.
No, although I had an interesting conversation with someone recently who's, has a major person in Scottish football, who I'd always, probably like yourself and many listeners, I'd always thought, in terms of getting the passion about the team, the more Celtic fans you could get in the team, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a guy, not talking about Celtic, he was talking about another club. But what I thought was interesting was, and this is a guy who's sits on a team bus on a regular basis, said that in terms of being able to have a decent performance after a defeat, it's better to not have your team stock full of fans of the club. Because see, if you get a horrific last minute, you're playing up in Inverness, and you're 2-1 up with a minute to go, and they score two goals in the last 2 minutes, and you lose the game 3-2. The pro is in a bad mood about it. And the pro who's a fan is in a bad mood about it. But see, if you use Glasgow as an example, if your team's based in Glasgow, by the time your bus has got from Inverness to Glasgow, your pro has started to think through aspects of the game and think through how they can deal with it. And then when he goes into training the next morning, the pro will have forgotten about the game because it will be all about focusing on the next game. Whereas the guy who's the fan will still be feeling down. And it's more difficult to lift the players who are fans of the club after a defeat than it is to lift the guy who's a pro. I've never thought of it that way before. I thought that made sense, but in terms of the existing team, give me your thoughts, because it's clear you've been unhappy with things.
Right, let me put my cards on the table and say that I am firmly behind Ronnie Dial and everything he's trying to achieve. And I want the team to be quicker, I want the team to be fitter, I want the team to have more energy, I want the team to press. And all the things that he's saying, I believe in totally. But I don't see any evidence so far of what he's trying to achieve. And I also I'm very frustrated by the formation that he plays. And he's obviously got his favourite formation, which is the 4-2-3-1. And as the manager, he's fighting Celtic to play what he sees is the best formation. But I think in the Scottish game, and I think Sunday was an example, we really need to play two up front, because the system that he's playing is fine for the European games. It's ideally suited, and I think the European results overall have been fairly decent. But in the Scottish game, we really need a twin partnership up front, because teams defend, and he's talking about playing a pressing game. It's hard to press a team who are just defending all the time. So you need to open them up, and you need to score goals, you need to create. And that's why I hope that Sunday was the first time of Ronnie acknowledging maybe that it's good to be flexible and change your tactics. It's great to have your favourite formation, but sometimes you've got to be a wee bit pragmatic and change your formation according to the opposition who you're playing.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm not so against a single striker. Whether you play a 4-2-3-1, as Ronnie Dyer had played for a large chunk of it, or whether you play a 4-3-2-1, whatever system you have where you've got some defence midfielders and an attacking group, I don't have a particular issue with a single spearhead to that if the attacking players who support, when you've got the ball at the edge of the box, effectively turn it into three or four attacking players. So I'm not so hung up that it has to be a partnership of two.
Yeah.
Although what I find interesting, like you, I have been perceiving that Ronnie Dyer has been playing a 4-2-3-1.
Mm-hmm.
Last week I spoke to someone connected with the coaching staff at Celtic who said, what are you talking about? He's been playing 4-3-3 for the last few weeks.
Mm.
And then pointed out that since he's changed to a 4-3-3, it's been pretty much the last six or seven games where we have, in the last seven games, we've won six and lost one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I've not, certainly on Saturday I spotted it, it was clear it was a 4-2-2. But this person was claiming that actually it's been more of a 4-3-3 for the bulk of the last seven games.
You know, that's a fair enough observation, but I just feel that regardless of what formation he's playing, I don't think we have the players suitable for fitting into the style of play or the formation that he wants to put in place. And I'll give you an example. I quite like Anthony Stokes. I know that's not very fashionable these days, but I think if you play Anthony Stokes through the middle with another striker, then in the Scottish game, he will get you between 20 and 30 goals a season. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Oh, I've got doubt about that.
Well, listen, look at his record. He scored goals with Falkirk, he scored goals with Hibs, and he scored a fair amount of goals.
In my ideal, Anthony Stokes would be a 7th or 8th choice striker for Celtic. That would be my ideal.
I know you're not a fan, but...
Because I don't think he's got a football brain. That's my problem with him.
Well, the thing is, do you think Anthony Stokes is a left winger? Because really, that's what Ronnie Dyer has been playing him in since the start of the season.
He's been playing... getting back to the point you just made, the argument this coach would make is he's been playing on the left side of a 4-3-3.
He's been playing... Let's be blunt about it. He's been playing wide left. And he's never in a million years a wide player. And him and Azagueri have got this sort of partnership where really what Stokes does is he hugs the ball and waits for Azagueri to overlap, and then he tries to pass the ball through him. And I'm not saying that 4-3-3 is a bad formation. The point I'm trying to make is that the Celtic personnel that Ronnie Dyer has got available to him, I don't think we have... I'm trying to think of a wide left player who's natural that you could play it in the flank. Probably Mubarak at a push, because he is left-footed and he seems to be a wide player. But Ronnie Dyer confuses me if he takes Anthony Stokes and he plays him in the left wing and thinks that's a good move. It's a total waste in my eyes.
But I do find it interesting, and I've made this point to somebody else, I find it interesting that Ronnie Dyer is the second Celtic manager who has tried Anthony Stokes out left in a 4-3-3.
Mm-hmm.
because Lennon tried it a few times as well.
He did, and it makes me think, actually, whether Stokes has a fancy for himself, being a wide left player. And personally speaking, I just think it's a waste of a jersey.
Well, I wonder whether, because the frustration of Stokes sometimes when he plays through the middle is he drifts too far off to the left. So I wonder whether the theory is, if we start him on the left, Stokes is not going to drift further left. So it might actually make him drift more inside. I don't know whether that's the theory. And, you know, I'm not going to sit and defend every decision of Ronnie Dyla's, because, again, the other player that I wouldn't be having in as much as he's having in is Charlie Mulgrew.
Yeah, Charlie's he's going for a good spell. I like Charlie Mulgrew as a player because I think he's a good defender and he plays the ball from defence. But certainly he has limitations in midfield, and I think that's been highlighted since the beginning of the season that he's just not comfortable in midfield. But see, just before we leave the formation thing, but whether it's 4-2-3-1 or it's 4-3-3 or whatever it is, if you've got Stokes right-footed out in the left and you've got Callum McGregor left-footed out in the right, I think that defeats the purpose of playing that formation. Because I think the whole thing is to have guys on either side who are quick, can get forward, get to the byline and get an early cross in for your striker in the centre. And it just does not happen. The boy McGregor constantly turns inside. He actually turns, pirouettes a full 360 degrees and turns the ball inside. And he's a good, I'm not criticising McGregor, he's a technically a good player, he's a good touch, he's a good passer of the ball, his movement's good. But, you know, I just get exasperated. I'm dying for James Forrest to get a wee run there, because if James Forrest can remain fit and plays in that role that McGregor is playing in, I think he would be absolutely outstanding.
Well, I mean, obviously, he's going for the inverted winger system that Strachan used to like that as well.
Where he did.
The guy, you put a right-footed player on the left-footed player on the right, and they cut inside.
Who was the right-footed player who played in the Leicester game? What was his name?
He tended to play... Often he played Nakamura on the right and McGeady on the left. And they would cut inside. And the concept is that the fullbacks then, your fullbacks effectively become wingers. Which is, and you could see it, I think you could see it away to Maribor, and you could see it, the intention, on Thursday night against Astra, as to why Charlie Mulgrew was playing. Because what seemed to be happening was the two centre-halves went really wide, almost into... When we had the ball, the two centre-halves went really wide, almost into full-back positions. Charlie Mulgrew dropped back, so that effectively when we had the ball, we had a three at the back.
And
Mulgrew sitting between
the
two centre-halves. And the two... fullbacks then were sitting in a midfield position, and then becoming wingers. And I can understand the thought, the logic behind that. It allows the fullbacks to push on. You've then got your two guys who are inverted wingers. They're cutting inside all the time, leaving space for the fullbacks to bomb on beyond, and the defender doesn't know where to stick or twist and go with them. I get the theory, and I got the theory when Strachan was doing it. Like you, I'm not sure that I like that system. But I get the theory behind it. And then that explains why you would play Charlie Mulgrew, because the player who's most suited to deviate between midfield and defence in that role would be Charlie Mulgrew.
I think the crux of the matter is going to come in the summer. I mean, if all goes to plan, then Dyla should win the league. I mean, if it isn't even that, it'll be an unmitigated disaster. But the whole thing is, he is trying to get his playing in a certain way and in a fashion that he believes in. And I do feel sorry for him, because he was thrown into that job at fairly short notice. And it's clear that the number of loan players that we got were just to get us through the season, to be frank. and most of them won't be there come the summer. And the real sort of judgment or Ronnie Dyer will come when he has to get his own men in that fit the method that he wants to play. And it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Interesting to see how what formation that he eventually goes with, but whether he'll stick with the two up front or he'll revert back to his favoured 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3 or whatever people want to call it. And in the summer, when he gets his own personnel, and if you like, the guys that he has taken time to look out and to sign.
Which then begs the question, I mean, obviously, Skefovic has now scored 2 goals in 2 games, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I remember speaking to a footballer who said, the problem is when you've not been playing well, no matter how hard you try not to just play your normal game. You know, if you come on as a sub, for example, no matter how hard you're telling yourself to just do the basics, you cannot help yourself that when you walk onto the field of play and you've only got 15 minutes, that you try to play like Pele for 15 minutes to prove that you should be starting the next week. And actually what ends up happening is you play worse than normal.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronnie Dyer made the comment about Skepovic prior to the Astra game that he could see he was a player who's really tense before it. Now, mm-hmm. hopefully, his 2 goals in the last 2 games, along with Guidetti scoring goals, might start to help spark things. What did you think of the team? Because they obviously playing the 2 up front as you've wanted. What did you think of the team's performance against Kilmarnock on Sunday?
I thought it was good with it actually hitting the heights, and I think in the first half the defence looked to be a bit vulnerable, which was unusual playing at home at Celtic Park, and there was a couple of times that, you know, like, I think Van Dijk in the last 2 games has been a wee bit lackadaisical. His mind seems to wander during the games, his concentration seems to drop. And I think Adam Matthews coming back into the team had a ropey game by his standard, but that was maybe to be expected because he's a wee bit rusty after being out for such a long time. But the thing I think Dial is going to need to look at is that they lack creativity in the midfield, and to be frank, they have done for a number of seasons, even under Lennon. And when you've got Johansson and Brown in the middle of the park, none of them are playmakers. They're runners. And they'll run all day for you, and they're full of energy, and you need that in the middle of the park. But I would just like to see somebody in midfield with a wee bit of class, somebody can put their foot in the ball and spread the ball a bit. And it was noticeable when we played Astra. In fact, when we played every European team this season, every team we've played has had a playmaker, a number 10. And it's guys that I've never heard of. But they've all been impressive in their own merits. And there must be players out there, and I hope that we can find one that you know, that we can put in there maybe, and if he plays his 4-2-3-1 formation, then hopefully the guy who is in the middle of the three will be a real ball player, a guy who can beat a man in a confined space, and you know, like play a through ball and have a wee bit of imagination. And I think we've got a good team, we've got a workmanlike team, but we lack a bit of class in the middle of the park.
And the strikers, I mean, I thought it was interesting you say about the game on Sunday that it was reasonable. I met a guy on Sunday night who's not been to a game this season, and I don't know whether because he's been reading how the negativity in the media,
mm-hmm.
he was saying he thought it was a great game, thought Celtic played great. So I don't know whether it's because, based mm-hmm. on the fact that he thought it was going to be dreadful.
I think you need to take into account the fact that Kilmarnock played a great deal of the game with 10 men. So it's maybe a wee bit harder to make a judgment. And the week before that, when we beat Ross County, if you're going to be... I don't subscribe to this, but somebody commented to me that Ross County weren't much opposition. But, you know, at the end of the day, you can only play who is put up against you. And I think there'll be bigger tests for Ronnie Dyer in the future. But I think at the moment, what we're doing well is we're getting... We're gaining a wee bit of momentum game by game, and it's to be hoped that on Wednesday against Thistle, we win that and the momentum continues And against Inverness, we won again, and the momentum continues. And I think that would give us a really big boost is if we could go to Romania and get a win.
Yeah.
Because see if you can qualify and get through to still be in the Europa League after Christmas. That's a great boost in a whole number of ways. Number one, it makes the season a wee bit more exciting and gives you something to look forward to. Number two, it gets the coefficient up, which I think people underestimate in this country. Number three, you may end up with a real glamorous game. You could end up with Inter Milan or Spurs or PSV Eindhoven and a really mouth-watering tie that would catch the imagination and would be a lucrative money earner for the club. So the Europa League, I certainly don't underestimate the Europa League. I think there's too many people out there that have been spoiled by the Champions League and looked in their noses at the Europa League. And I like European football. I like pitting your wits against teams that you don't see and teams that have different styles and that come from different cultures.
I think you and I, in that regard, are probably from the same situation in that for the bulk of our formative years as Celtic fans, it was just at the end of the European glory years.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through a long period where, yeah, you would have a fantastic night where you beat Juventus at Celtic Park, lose the away game, mm-hmm. and yeah, it was fantastic, but we're out of Europe by October, November.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And even now, 10, 11 years of the majority of time getting post-Christmas European football, I still covet how fantastic that is. Because I've been going to Celtic mm-hmm. Park for 40 years. So the bulk of the 40 years I've gone to Celtic Park, I've not had European football after Christmas.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that front. And I think it's something you should never underestimate. And I do think the longer you go in the Europa League, the more interest will come along. I think if we qualify and get through, then it keeps up the... if you look at the broader picture, it keeps up the Scottish name in Europe. And I don't think you're getting the credit for that because, you know, there's teams there that like, even a country like Greece, Olympiacos are setting quite a blaze in the Champions League. And then you've got Panathinaikos and you've got Athens and there's a few other teams in there. So their coefficient as a collective has gone up. We can't rely on anybody. I mean, in the old days, certainly, the Rangers might have pitched in a wee bit, and that was a help in some sort of cat-candid way that we helped each other to get the coefficient up.
But the other aspect of it, which it's not something I agree with, but you get the same points for winning a game in the Europa League as you do for winning a game in the Champions League.
I know, and I can't help it. That shouldn't be right. It should be... I think the reason why UEFA do that is they don't want the Europa League to be seen as a second-class competition.
No.
And if you didn't get the same points for winning, etc., then people would kick a stink up. But it used to kill me a few years ago. Newcastle went through a wee spell under Bobby Robson. And I'm sure, in coefficient terms, they were something like the fourth team in Europe at one point. Because every year they went into the Europa League and they either got to the quarterfinals or the semi-finals. And that coefficient every year was a biggie. They were maybe getting a coefficient of between 12 and 15 a season. So over the five-year spell it's taken into account, Newcastle had this huge coefficient and yet never played one game in the Champions League at that period. And that used to kill me. We were beating at that point teams like Anderlecht and AC Milan in the Champions League and yet they weren't getting the exposure they were getting.
And the other thing that gets me about Europa League and not everybody going is half the people who are not going are exactly the same people who would tell you how much they would love Celtic to play in an Atlantic League, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Europa League is the same sort of quality as the Atlantic League would be.
Definitely. And let's not kid ourselves. I was watching Astra the other night. Astra would beat anybody in Scotland.
Yeah.
And I happen to think that they beat them convincingly. And they're the button boys in the group. And Zagreb, I thought, were technically excellent. And Salzburg, I think, probably have the better class of player in the group than anybody else, only because it's the old money thing again. They've obviously got backers and they've got these players that are coming from different continents and making a wee difference. So it's always a wee educated European football for your Celtic fan, average Celtic fan. We were always a knowledgeable team. A knowledgeable fan base. Because when we were younger, we were brought up to appreciate the finer points of the game. And when you saw a European team play at Celtic Park, you took notice of what you were watching. Now, you saw some very good ones. You also saw some... When you think back to the Atletico Madrids and the Rapid Viennas and some of the things that were happening at times, and it was definitely an experience, if I can describe it like that. But there was other times as well when we played Dynamo Kiev, and they were probably one of the most impressive teams I've ever seen at Celtic Park. They were that team of that period, but they were absolutely outstanding. And there were other ones as well that came and you would never fail to be amazed. But there was always something. There was always something exciting about European football, and I think people played in the Europa League at their cost.
The bulk of, as I keep going on about, the bulk of Europe doesn't. England does, and I can't stand the mentality of England. If they're all pressing to get European football, and as soon as they get it, oh, I wish we had, you know, the media in particular, the English media in particular, I bet the manager wishes he hasn't had it. Well, that's not understanding football, fans. Because I tell you what, if I was supporting one of these mid-table teams in England who never get relegated, never get a chance of winning anything, it must be boring as hell being a supporter of one of those clubs. And I've heard supporters of those clubs going on and saying that one of the things that frustrates them is this modern culture of their manager thinking that what the fans really want is to win, finish ninth, when actually what the fans would dearly love would be to win a trophy and get some European football if they could. You know, it's like Arsene Wenger, who's turned achieving third or fourth place in the English Premiership. Well, getting third or fourth place in the English Premiership is an achievement. No, it's not.
He describes that as winning a trophy. Or comparable to winning a trophy. Which is absolute madness. And the other thing as well I noticed during the week there was Liverpool had a good season, certainly last season. They were unlucky that they didn't win the league title. But apparently they've brought a DVD celebrating the fact that they finished second. Now, for somebody that can remember Bill Shankly and Bob Paisley, they'll be turning in their graves, because second at Liverpool was failure at one point, and now they're making DVDs about it.
Yeah, and I just don't like us falling into that culture of going down the route of what the way the English media talk about the game when I think there's so much that's wrong with that. And I, for one, actually for some time I've thought to myself that a period a season in the Europa League, one out of four seasons in the Europa League would not be the worst thing that we could have, provided that one season in the Europa League gets us to last 16 or last 8. Which is what our target should be. If we think that perhaps once in a blue moon, you know, once every second season we'd like to get to the last 16 of the Champions League, then the concept that we should be able to get to the last 8 of the Europa League shouldn't be beyond us.
Now, the point I was making there is as well, and I go back to it, is we have to get that coefficient up, because while we have the club's sort of game plan at the moment is to win the league, get into the Champions League, and get the Champions League money. Now, I think Lovell's on record as saying he wants us in the Champions League 3 out of every 5 years minimum. And if that's to be the case, then we have to be seeded in the qualifiers. Because if we start to fail in Europe and the results decline, and therefore your coefficient goes down, there's no way we're going to get into Champions League qualifiers against seeded teams and beat them. Not a chance. So our best chance comes, as you say there, is if we are in the Europa League, We have to make the best of it and get the coefficient points up there, which ensure that we are still seeded when it comes to the Champions League qualifiers, because that gives us the best chance of going through.
I tell you one other thing that bugs me about the Europa League and the people who don't go to the Europa League, and I know people, you know, whenever you make a comment about people not going, somebody always says, you know, well, I couldn't go because my granny's, you know, falling down the stairs, or, you know, and rightly people will comment about the cost of going to watch football. My point would always be, yeah, but if we were playing the Champions League instead of the Europa League, we would have a full house, and there would still be supporters who granny had fallen ill that night, and there would still people, unfortunately, there would still be people who couldn't afford to go. But the fact is, the people who could afford to go would be going.
If we were playing Real Madrid in the Champions League, people would be stepping over their granny had fell down the stairs to go over them to get out the door to get to the game.
Yep. And so getting moved from my seat bugs me for Europa League football. And I know why the club do it, because having people sparsely around the ground costs a lot more money and also doesn't look very good. So I know why the club do it. So I'm not criticising the club on this one. It bugs me that I get moved. And as a consequence of getting moved to the lower tier, because I'm in the north tier upper, I get soaked on Thursday night. The guy next, so I've been saying for a while, see if we get to the last 32, or more specifically the last 16 of the Europa League, and suddenly all these people want to go. There should genuinely be a large differential in price between those people who are going for these games and those people who went for the Europa League, because the absolute basics of it are, the players in the park are paid for by the supporters going through the turnstiles. So the supporters who decide not to go to the games that they can't be bothered with, but go to the games of the last 16 or the last 8, if we got there, would be benefiting from the people who went to the other games paying the wages of the players for us to get there. So those of us who went should be rewarded. I would have the differential at 20, 30 quid, but probably not. Guy next to me has got a different idea as we were getting soaked. On Thursday night, he wants everybody who turns up for the last 16 game who wasn't at the Astra game, he wants that everybody who was at the Astra game gets to throw a bucket of water at them so they can so they can live through what we've lived through for that game.
Listen, the Astra game on Thursday night would be more than a bucket of water. Ice bucket challenge would be more appropriate. That was I get caught in it on Thursday night. That was torrential. It was horrible. So
it was. So we are now in the same position that we were for two of the last three seasons after 10 games in terms of points. We're in a better position than we were in one of those in the last four seasons, and in a worse position of one of the last four seasons. The point being, we're actually, with the exception of last season, we've got roughly the same amount of points that we always have after 10 games.
I mean, you and I were having a wee debate. And we're talking about lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yeah.
So you can make a lot. You can make mostly anything out of statistics, but I would look further than that and say that I have to say that overall I'm disappointed by the level of performance this season. And I would be willing to take a few bad results if I thought the performances were a wee bit more optimistic. And that's not a criticism. That's an observation in my part. From where I'm sitting, I'm not very impressed by a lot of the performances this season. And I know what you're talking about the statistics and certainly in terms of winning games, you're doing well enough. You know, like the Hamilton game is a big disappointment, I've got to say. Although we missed a few chances that day, I think overall we were fairly poor. But I just think that the majority of the games we've played this season hasn't excited me. And part of the thing about being a Celtic fan in this country is we do put a premium on playing football a certain way, and I don't think we're getting that at the moment, although I'm willing to be patient and stick with them and hope that it comes to fruition eventually.
I agree with you, and I suppose that's why I was sort of letting you talk about Billy McNeil's first season, where the football wasn't great, but it started to come good once he'd had the players for a while and once he got to the new year. And that's all I'm hoping for, that once Ronnie Dyla's had the players for a while, things will start to improve, and that it might not be overnight. You know, and people might be excuse me, bemoaning the fact that it might be into into the next year. As somebody said to me, at this stage in Europe, maybe he's just a lucky European manager, in that we've not played particularly well, but here we are sitting on pretty much one win away from being through to the last 30, qualify from the group.
Mm-hmm. I think we're on the luck a wee bit against Zagreb. Zagreb were, the tour, if it wasn't for Craig Gordon, it could easily have been a 3-1 defeat rather than a 1-0 victory. And I think the other thing, when I look at the Zagreb game, it takes the same pattern as a few games. We start the game well, and we're doing okay, and then for some reason, particularly in the second half, the team seems to lose their shape. I don't know if it's because they're still getting used to the way he wants them to play. I don't know if it's because somebody actually said to me that he reckons that the players are getting overtrained. Now, I don't subscribe to that, but I'm willing to take it on board as a possibility, because something does happen late in the game. We don't finish the game strongly. Under Ronnie Dial, I've noticed that. We seem to lose shape and lose energy as the game wears on. We start well, but we can't carry it through. And the longer the game goes, I think we suffer from a lack of energy. And I don't know if that's because of the... I really don't know.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I did think that the Zagreb game, I found funny listening to the podcast, actually, of Radio Scotland afterwards, where, with no sense of irony, in almost the same breath, Chick Young was critical of Ronnie Dyler for talking about the fitness of the players needing to improve, and then talked about the speed and fitness of the Zagreb players being above the Celtic players. So
I don't think that they were fitter than us that night. I think they were more technically gifted. And I know that you and I had this argument before, that the point I was making was that you don't necessarily need to have the fastest, fittest players to play a system. I would rather have the technically gifted guy who is fit rather than have a super fit guy who doesn't have any technique.
Yeah,
and I think Zagreb were an example of that, because every one of their players was comfortable on a ball, and they passed the ball and they kept the shape of their team.
But my point would be, all the Celtic players are of a certain technical ability, because the very fact that they're on Celtic's books means they must be of a certain technical standard.
Mm-hmm.
And what will make them better players is the ability to use that technique at a quicker pace.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes players look better. In any sport, the guy who looks as though he's got far more time on the ball than anybody else, it's just because he can do everything a lot more quickly if he wants to. Consequently, that's what it is. But that's why I'm prepared to give Ronnie Dyler the season. I think we'll win the league. And yes, if we got to February and we were 10, 12 points off the top, then yeah, you have to seriously consider that our whole business plan cannot exist with us not winning the league in the current setup. So yeah, you'd have to address it. But I don't think that'll be the case.
I'll tell you something that I discussed with a friend of mine. Seeing in the days before the Ross County game, obviously things hadn't went very well, and beforehand, and the loss to Hamilton, and there was a few results, and certainly the performances weren't as good as we were all hoping. So there's a wee bit of pressure on Ronnie Dyler. And me and this guy were talking, and we said, twice in our lifetime in recent years, you've witnessed the end of Celtic managers actually during a game. The first one was John Barnes against Inverness.
Yep.
Where, I don't mind admitting, I was watching it thinking, you're away here in the morning, because this can't be tolerated. Is it the money you spent, and the I think the dressing room revolt, the Viduki and that kind of thing, he had to go at that point, because he lost control, quite frankly. John Barnes had lost control. The second one was Tony Mowbray that night at Love Street, where we were beating 4-0. And then towards the end of the game, he ended up with like a back three.
Yeah.
It was like a 3-0-7 formation. It was mind-boggling looking back in it. So again, during that game, I'm thinking to myself, nah, this is a he's another one. He's damaged goods. He'll have to be away tomorrow morning also. So it actually crossed our mind. It's a horrible thought because I genuinely want Ronnie Dyer to do well. But, number one, because I'm a Celtic fan and I don't care who the manager is as long as we're successful. And number two, I believe he's a genuinely nice guy and I've got a lot of sympathy for him coming from a background in Norway where I don't think he's any way prepared for the basket case mentality that we've got in this country. So what you were saying is, if we'd have went to Ross County that day and just through a quirk of fate we'd have lost 2 or 3 nothing, then I wonder if the Celtic board would have had the backbone to continue with Ronnie Dyer if the fans revolted.
But getting on your point of having seen it, like you, the Tony Mowbray thing was interesting because I remember actually thinking the benefit of this defeat, the nature of that defeat to St Mirren was you knew that Tony Mowbray was finished.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit, if there was one, of such a catastrophic defeat and such a huge defeat was it would all be over quickly. It's like ripping plaster off. And the opposite of that is I also... you know, it had been arranged well in advance before the lunchtime kickoff. When we were 3-0 down at half time to Kilmarnock, I was walking in to have lunch with my wife, saw the score, and thought to myself, oh well, that'll be the end of Neil Lennon. It's a shame.
That's the end, yeah.
And
it could have been.
I was absolutely stunned when I switched on my phone to find out that we hadn't lost that game.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was, it showed the nature of what he could when it came down to it, get out of his team. And you could argue, I'm not saying it was as catastrophic as that, but you could argue things were getting close to being a problem for Ronnie Dyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get 5 goals out of his team against Ross County. In the same way that Neil Lennon managed to get 3 goals in the second half out of his team against Kelly.
I'm going to make another point here. I'm going to be critical of our supporters. And I don't normally advocate that, but I think there's a point that has to be made. Now, that day at Kilmarnock, I was there that day at Kilmarnock. That was my boy's first away game, and I don't think I'll ever forget it for a whole number of reasons. But at 3-0 at half-time, I was proud of the fans because they never turned in the team and they certainly never turned in Neil Lennon. They made their disapproval loud that they were 3-0 down, but it wasn't vitriolic and it wasn't personal.
Mm-hmm.
And when the team came out in the second half, I was heartened that day because the supporters went mental and they were singing it, and it was almost like defiance. And in some small way, they helped to drag the team back from the brink. And I was proud of the supporters that day, and I think that Neil Lennon himself never underestimated the importance that the supporters had in gaining that result. But I happen to believe if we went to Rugby Park next week and we were 3-0 down at half time, Ronnie Dyer wouldn't get Neil Lennon was given a bit of slack because he was Neil Lennon.
Yeah.
Because he had a Celtic background and he had that link with the Celtic fans. And I don't think Ronnie Dyer would be given that. I don't think the fans would be that patient. I think they would turn on him more easily than they would, and I don't like using this quote, but one of their own.
Yeah.
Whether it was Neil Lennon's a manager, or Danny McGrain's a manager, or John Kennedy's a manager, they would show a wee bit more patience with a Celtic man than they would with an outsider. And I think that what Ronnie Dyer is doing at the moment is he is trying to go from being the outsider to one of us, one of our own, and be accepted as one of our own. The same way that Vin Jansen did it, the same way that, you know, Martin O'Neill did it, they came as outsiders, but they managed to become part of the fabric within a short space of time.
And the other thing, from the images that we saw of Ronnie Dyer before he came, you know, the stripping off to his waist and doing the press-ups, from the big roar thing that he did with the Dundee fans, the other reason why I'm desperate to succeed is, given time and given a fan base who, and sometimes this is what frustrates me about the Celtic fans, they sit and bemoan the media, but very easily follow the media line when the media are peddling an anti-Celtic agenda. I think you said it before.
Yeah.
Sometimes Celtic fans can be a bit like people who follow horoscopes or people reading horoscopes in the paper. They'll tell you the load of rubbish until the horoscope says something they want to hear. And then they believe it. Everything about what I've seen of Ronnie Dyla makes me think, I actually think if we could let him, if we could let him in, if you know, getting back to your point of being part of our club, and this isn't about being this nonsense about being Celtic manager. I just mean being part of the, you know, part of, and I don't mean one of us in the Celtic family thing. You'll know the point I mean. Just like you would do at work when you break down the barriers and somebody comes in, and he's one of the guys. He's one of the gang.
Just be part of the group.
I think if we let Ronnie Dyla in, I could see if we can get the team playing right and if we can get things, I can see the fans really galvanising behind him, and I could see us going places if we could get it right.
I think that there's definite reasons for optimism, and I think that there's tremendous potential as a manager. But the point I was trying to make there is, if we were seeing nothing down at Rugby Park and the fans are howling and bawling, do you think the board have got the backbone, the strength, or mental strength to carry on them?
Yes.
No, I would hope so.
I think no matter the two managers that have had the catastrophic failure at Celtic, John Barnes and Tony Mowbray, have both been seen through to the February.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be the same for Ronnie Dyla.
Yeah, yeah.
If things weren't going right, but hopefully they will. And something he said after the game on Sunday reconfirmed something I thought prior to the Hearts game. Something that Strachan worked out, Lennon never bothered with, Martin O'Neill worked out. Mm-hmm. It's to get the fans on board that's really important to win the first trophy you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taking the League Cup seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So our next game is against Partick Thistle. What do you think the team will be and how do you think it will go?
I think, judging by the last round against Hearts, he will play the strongest team possible. And I'm a great believer in continuity in a team, especially when you're playing well and you're getting results. And Jock Stein used to have a saying that used to say, winning's a great habit to get into, because it's easy to get into a... once you've got that, it gives you mental strength and makes you a better team. And I think it makes players better players. Winning games definitely, you know, there's no doubt about it, it grows confidence. So in terms of the team, I don't think there's a lot of changes that you could make. I hope he continues with the two up front. And the only thinking I think that he may go along with is if he plays a four-man midfield, the two guys that are wide players, ever since the season started, haven't really been convincing. Now, the boy McGregor has certainly scored a few goals and made a wee impact. But Tonev and Mubarak have been distinctly average.
I've seen more in Mubarak than Tonev. I don't think Tonev will be getting his option exercise to buy.
Well, somebody else was telling me that Mubarak's option is £4 million, and with the best ball in the world on the current form, I don't think he's I wouldn't be for £4 million from anyway. But the point I'm trying to make here is, if you can get James Forrest maybe back in Wednesday night, wide right, and who could you put wide left? I really don't know off the top of my head. But that's the only tinkering I think he'll do. I think he will keep the spine of the team, the goalkeeper, the back four, the two main men in midfield, which tend to be Brown and Johansson these days. And if he plays the two strikers up front, then the only tinkering that I think that he's going to do is the guys who are wide in the midfield area.
And the score?
I think 2-0 again would be realistic in Wednesday night. Very, very similar to the Kilmarnock game, probably.
Okay. Well, I will be speaking to you in the next couple of weeks when we talk about your book. But as for tonight, thanks for joining us, St. Anthony.
Good man, Harry.
I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Cheers.
Pleasure. Deserts.
Sudan.
Hopefully you enjoyed that podcast, and I'm sure, like me, you're looking forward to Celtic winning the next three or four games and being in a very strong position in all competitions. And also you're probably looking forward to St Anthony's book about the 78-79 season, and specifically the 4-2 game when 10 men won the league. I'm sure you don't need to work out what the music relates to. It relates to St Anthony's book, and as I pointed out in the podcast we discussed at the beginning, there'll be more of that in the next couple of weeks as his book comes to launch. But enough from me. That was him, St Anthony, and this is me, Harry Bernini, saying good night. Good night.
In the wilds of Borneo and the vineyards of Bordeaux, Eskimo, Arapaho move their body to and fro. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me, hit me, das ist gut, say fantastic. Hit me, hit me, hit me, hit me with your rhythm stick, it's nice to be a lunatic. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Stick.